We still have a little bit of time, which we would like to use in the following way. I have a little proposition for question for the participants in the panel, which should last just a couple of minutes. And afterwards, I would like to open it up for the public to pose a series of questions, maybe two or three or four, that will be then recycled and answered according to the participants' interest in what you have said. So I guess what I wanted to pose is a kind of triangular network of relations. This idea of democracy as practice, this idea of democracy as political strategy, democracy as survival. But then if you linked and networked all of this together, that would read something like democracy as practice, as political strategy, as survival. So I wonder if some of you or all of you could address how you position yourselves within the form that you have articulated for your work and how that relates to democracy as a constructed practice or your artistic practice as a form of democracy rather. So I'll just leave it there.
Please.
So I want to begin by saying I wish I had more time to discuss your works than I have. How's that better? I'm ensconced in a university. I don't know if there are other people who are employed by universities here. And when I was a younger activist, I did a lot of activism in high school and college. I thought a lot about platforms, and I think all platforms are viable platforms, and therefore you need to think about what your skill set is good for and what platform then you should ideally operate on. And so when you ask the question, position yourself in the project that you're doing, the discipline of art history in the United States is incredibly Eurocentric. It's homophobic and it's sexist as a discipline. It's changing. But I decided that my early work would be about changing the way race is understood in the tradition of visual culture studies, and I've written several projects on that. In relationship to democracy, I would say that the way that people survive in relationship to the racism in the United States is through forms of visual survival that they share among themselves initially, and I think about here all kinds of critical art movements, black arts movements, Chicano art movements, other kinds of art movements that do that kind of work, and that that it's a kind of survival that's about image making and preserving. And then if the scholar then is able to articulate that to a broader public, sort of like bringing that archive that's invisible to visibility, then that is ideally the role that that subject can play.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll take a stab at it. It's not dissimilar for me. I think democracy as a term is problematic for me because I've spent a lot of time in places where democracy has been used as a cloak for imperialism. But if I were to apply it in any way to my practice, I would probably look at it in terms of historiography, going back also to what Miguel was talking about, and the archive, and this question of the archive. And this relates more to a completely different project that I didn't talk about today, but it really is, which is an archive. But also in all of my work, I think that there is this question, which I'm constantly asking myself with every project, of what is left out of the historical narrative and why, and where my work can intervene in that.
For me, for example, democracy is a huge headache, I would say. And in terms of, you have to disciplinize yourself always, you have to remind yourself about democratic practices. When you're sleeping, I would say. Because you never, whenever you've already acknowledged what is the value of its goals, you will never forget about it in your daily practices. So that's kind of very important things for me, not only to include it into my art practices, but to my daily life. And yeah, and I think for all of us it's quite the same, because whenever you think about equality as a value, so you start practice, you cannot help yourself, you cannot quit. And this is, you know, a huge job of discipline. I mean, should take a lot of time, a lot of effort, and this is, there's no range after that.
I mean, I think within the practices that we were talking about, within Ultra Red and these kind of histories of popular education, I think that one of the things that comes up again and again, maybe it doesn't fit exactly this trial, but is the kind of relationship between the micro-political democracies and the macro-political democracies, and how to negotiate those, and how, you know, kind of small and things that people don't tend to a lot of the time in groups, which can also be become incredibly emetic if you focus on them for too long, you know, are really important, and then at the same time what happens when they interface with kind of macro political conditions. And I think that interface is something that kind of probably has a lot to do with survival on some level, not in an extreme sense, but how do you attempt to kind of survival of the group is, whether it's on a demonstration or whether it's taking over a kind of local government, which is the case of Maywood, or how does one negotiate those two relations to each other? I mean, sorry, just and that's the practice of listening is really important in that, because listening often in our practices unsettles relations in a different way maybe than sort of visual looking at things as listening kind of a practice that people are used to when they're thinking about democracy, listening to sound objects that have been produced, trying to understand what they mean, embodying that experience, and listening to each other, reflecting on it. Those kinds of practices are quite, I don't know, sometimes challenging for people, but also create a kind of dynamic relationship with embodiment and the embodiment of knowledge and these kind of other processes of visual representation or kind of macro political vocal representation.
It's not that easy. I will try to think in regard of my presentation. For example, the importance of performativity or what I call democracy as an act. You know, like you make it happen in the sense that if you, for example, you feel that you don't fit in the way that you know the society is constructed, you have to create a space. You know, and you have to, and this is mainly what you were calling said democracy as survival. Yes, I mean, I guess in one way or another, we are talking about the same here. I mean, the fiction. The Trump is like this. I mean, how fiction can have political effects, you know, and actually create new alternative, a real alternative, an organized, another possibilities, you know, for us to be recognized and to create, and also to question. And for me, it was very, very important. And maybe the idea of effects, of effect, los efectos, is important also, you know, because how can you create a network of affects? How can you feel like accompanied with, you know, I don't know if that's you know, if that's more democratic or not, but the thing is that we actually need to create the imaginaries and the references and the words and the images that are politically necessary to us to keep living. And that's an important thing for me.
Just super quick. I think there's perhaps a tension or maybe even a useful contradiction to talk about. And that is the act of producing the representation and the act of receiving the representation. And I think perhaps confusing those two things makes it almost impossible to talk about democracy. And that the performance of the reception of the representation is precisely what we don't see in formal democratic institutions. That is the organization of the effects. We see the policing of the effects, we see the controlling of the effects, we see the incarceration of the effects, but the organization of those effects in terms of their accumulation, their embodiment, and actually seeing the contradictions of those effects as productive, as opposed to the things that need to be suppressed and incarcerated. I think perhaps this is a contradiction worth exploring some more.
Thank you. We'll take some, maybe two or three questions from the audience. Please, back there.
She's going.
I have a question to Mahmoud Al-Qaeda from Al-Qaeda. Because here, Sambalji proposed these two forms or models of democracy, deliberative and radical. So how do you think we should value them from the point of view of listening? Because my question is that radical democracy doesn't really look so well. It's rather deaf and mute. There's a lot of communication going on to form political subjectivity inside, but not so much discussion on the other side. On the other hand, the deliberative model, you know, the critic of it, it's consensus is always exclusive and so on. But when we look at the actual practice of, for instance, General Assemblies, they seem definitely closer to deliberative model than radical one. So what's your point on this?
Do you want to respond to now or
no,
should we?
Let's
okay, let's get another question, please. And we should go back to you. If there are any, of course.
We're just going to collect like three or four questions and answer them all together.
Please.
I'd just like to know that I'm having experience with liquid democracy, which is being experimented with by, I think, the Pirate Party in Berlin, for example.
Take another question, if there is one. So do you want to have us take up these questions?
I have to admit, I'm really sorry. I wasn't really able to listen to what you said because the sound was so bad. But I'll try to repeat, and if you disagree, and if it's something else that you want me or us to address, because I think it kind of refers to all three of our statements, then you just repeat your question. What I understood was that you are interested in this kind of gap or tension between the deliberative and radical politics, and that your argument was actually that there's not so much radical forms of democracy are kind of mute. You can't do like at this time, so you can't really listen to them because they're not so many. Is that
how do you value both of them from the point of view of listening?
Say that again, sorry.
How do you value both of them from the point of view of listening?
I think that, you know, what I try to do in all these kind of oppositions that I came up with, or that, you know, just to kind of make something explicit, is that there is a tension between the two, and that this is actually what our attempts to aspire to democracy should look at when we ask about it. So there's probably an unresolved discussion around these two different strands of democracy. And they're both, I would say, in some ways, liberal solutions. They're both critical to what has just been called de-democratization and, you know, the facade of democracy and all that. So these are two already critical ways. But if we were to choose these critical ways, and if we look at this tension that kind of became the condition of our thinking, then the question that we would kind of look at in our investigations is actually not to kind of say that there is no tension, but to make this contradiction something that we kind of try to listen to in exactly these attempts. So for example, just Jenna was talking about the silence that you kind of addressed as well. In Don's sound object, there was exactly this tension between the deliberative and so on. So, you know, what do we learn from listening to this, and what new terms can we generate from this contradiction? In my sound object, you know, we don't have much time to discuss these things. I would be very happy to ask the question to the audience, what did you hear? Because when I was there, and I was very, very pleased to be there, it was an incredibly interesting experience to be in Frankfurt after 2 days of a city that was blocked by police, and where even kindergarten were closed, and schools were closed, and there was no possibility to have a wedding anymore. So all these everyday life things, they were blocked. And they were not blocked by the protesters, but from the other side, okay? Then came the demonstration, and there were many, many people on the streets, and it was beautiful to be there. But listening to the sound of the demonstration, you feel that there is something towards a radical form of democracy, towards a democracy as practice, that cannot be hurt. So from the analysis of this contradiction that we can then put into process, we have to ask the questions, how can the silence that Jan was talking about, that usually always follows after such moments of activism, how can we put that into a democratic practice? How can they translate into the everyday life? I think this is, how can we organize them? Exactly. So that is the question that we have to ask ourselves. That's what we believe. And then, you know, on this way, we start developing it. And, you know, and then in a general way, but this is a long discussion, I would disagree. I think there's so many ways of listening and seeing democracy today, but, you know, there's also at the same time so many ways of de-democratizing. So we are in a very interesting historical moment that is completely unresolved.
Does anyone want to answer any of the other questions?
I'd like to respond to the de-democratizing question, actually, and bring us back to the question of affect that was raised sort of tantalizingly in a couple of the papers, and pursued a little bit in the last comment. And it's in other writings, I argue that affect is probably the primary commodity of capitalism, and that what in fact is rather critical in the production of new visual forms as well as new auditory forms is the production of different kinds of affect. And it seems to me that one of the things that Ultra Red is interestingly doing is trying to think about the way sounds can produce affect by showing anxiety and anger and these kinds of states of being. And I was thinking also about the way video operates differently in producing affect than still images, and how democracy has traditionally been represented as certain kinds of politeness and stillness, and that that very form of representation is a kind of repression of affect. But because capitalism is so effectively producing affect, we need to find ways that are as effective as at affective production, and that I think is a real call. So coming back to de-democratization, it seems to me that this last little bit of my talk I didn't get to, I'm not going to take long at all, is just to point out that you won't be surprised to learn that a new policy development in the US limits media access to police operations. So now you can be arrested for photographing the police if the image has no apparent aesthetic value. So you think about the way art begins to interface with the state in a condition of de-democratization right there.
We have to wrap up really quickly, but we have time either for one more intervention from the participants or one last question from the audience, if there is a last time. Okay. Mary,
yeah, I can build on what Jennifer was saying briefly. The somewhat extraordinary access that I had to the constitutional lawyer was in fact a result of being an artist and not a member of the official press, because the official press was actually restricted to the plenary tent, and they only had access to the official narrative of the assembly. And since I was not a member of the official press, I actually was allowed to see much, much more than they were. An artist was, I guess, either considered more harmless or somehow my role was somehow less defined in a way that gave me a really extraordinary freedom of the space. And I was able to take a really stunning amount of rhetoric about transparency and accessibility that was being thrown around at this moment and really take it literally and make it very literal. And that, I think, was one of those moments when art actually did take advantage of a state of exception.
Thank you, Mary. And that will close.
Just one last comment. One of the things I wanted to not let leave to the dust. Some point, Mary, that I think you were making when you talked about the Jigger taking 4 weeks.
Yes.
I think this is, you know, this tension between activism and organizing. Democracy takes time. And activism refuses time. And what do we do with that?
The marathon will continue. There will be a whole other group of presenters, another professor coming up on stage. We ask you to stick around, stretch if you need, and we'll see you in a second.
You need a stretch.